case.
Okay, so the yes, discussion was not in intense enough, so I posted the references from some older references and some new references, both on particle diffusion and mobility of particles, and how it, from looking at anomalous diffusion, you can get information about modes of polymer melt. And also, I posted the information on this experiment and the, one of the most recent theories on this effect of slowing down near the surfaces. So you can look at it and we can have further discussions. Okay, on this work that I'm going to be talking about today, there is not yet any publication. This work was just accepted today to Science, so I'll talk about the results that haven't been published yet. So the, for those of you who haven't attended yesterday's review of by Arnie on cystic fibrosis, I'll give a little bit of a review of what I'm going to be talking about. So we can survive days without food, weeks without food, days without water. We can survive hours without email, but some of us can. It's but we can hardly survive more than minutes without air. And so, why is this such an important part of our life? And it has to do with the fact that we constantly have to deliver oxygen to our bloodstream and remove CO2 from it at with a frequency of seconds, minutes are already pushing the lab survivability. So we need to completely refresh this 5 liters of blood in our body with oxygen. We have to remove CO2 and put oxygen there. And so 5 liters is about 20 centimeters cubed. And if you look at the diffusion coefficient of oxygen in water, which is, or in blood, it's about 3×10⁻⁵, on time scales of seconds, it only diffuses hundreds of microns, not centimeters. And so to have this diffusive exchange, you need to reduce at least one of those dimensions down to this length scale, which is size of terminal arterioles. So if you have a conserved volume, I want to squeeze one dimension down, which is a factor of about 4,000. At conserved volume, it means that the two other dimensions, or the product of them, have to increase by the same factor. So you go from 20×20 centimeters to 10×10 meters. So you have to have an effective tennis court of interface. So to just satisfy this condition, and by the way, I do want interruptions and questions. So if you have any questions, please stop me and ask questions.
After the arterioles are the capillaries. There is no diffusion in the capillaries.
There is in capillaries. There is it's only the places where you have contact between air pipes and blood vesicles. That's where you have diffusion. So when you get to bigger capillaries, there is you don't have as much contact. So most of the exchange occurs on the small on the finest mesh of the blood vesicles. That's I'll show you how the area goes. So the how to rapidly deliver all of this air to this tennis court of interface, and the solution, if you basically solve engineering problem, is this fractal structure where you start with a single pipe called trachea. And then it branches into bronchus, and it keeps branching 23 times until it gets to the final length scale at the end. So if you count generations, generation 0 would be trachea, generation 1 would be bronchi, and the number of pipes in a generation Z is 2 to the Z, and so by the end you get about 10,000 pipes. And
10 million.
Thank you. 10 million. So this is like a cast of this structure, which has all of this fine. It's not all of it. It's just first about 6 or 7 generations. And the solution happens to be the case where you have a constant volume per generation, so number of pipes times the volume of each pipe, where this diameter of a pipe is about constant. So if you solve this, you find that diameter decreases exponentially every generation as 2 to the power z over 3. So this is the plot of average diameter of airway taken experimentally as a function of generation. So this is log over diameter versus generation. It decreases exponentially, and this line is this equation. So it starts with centimeters and gets down to submillimeters. And so the first about 14 generations is follows this lowest co-respiratory part, sorry, conducting part, and then the remaining 10 generations is a respiratory part. And it has a slightly different law. And so most of the length of this is in first few generations, because it's exponential decaying function. And so by the time you get to generation 10, you're almost all the way down to your surface. But so this is the plot of distance from the generation 0 to generation z. And this is a log of the cross-sectional area, or the area of the vesicles, and it grows exponentially. Because it's number of generations times the cross-sectional area, total cross-sectional area, it increases exponentially, and so you can see that the conducting part is a smaller fraction, and then it keeps diverging. And most of the area is in large generations. And that's how you reduce the air drag. And so this is the structure of lungs. You have about first 14 generations of conducting airways, and then the remaining 10 generations respiratory airways. And the picture is how it transfers. This is sort of done to answer your question. Most of the exchange occurs in between alveoli, where you have air sacs, and the blood vesicles that are surrounding alveoli. That's where most of the area is. You have capillaries, but there isn't much of exchange there. I mean, it's not very significant. And so if you just estimate how many alveoli there are there, the alveoli diameter is about 0.1 millimeter. That's the, and the number is 300 million. Approximately, if you multiply that, you're getting roughly a tennis court of area. So that's sort of the brief review of physiology of lung. So any questions on this?
An idea why this particular structure, why does it help?
Well, which particular structure?
The bumps.
Well, this is like great. This is how you surround. It's like the I think the idea is that you want to get as much area as possible with the smallest distance, and you are making your, if you have just a pure sphere, you'll have less area than if you have this reproduced surface. So you're trying to maximize area at the same distance. But I guess these bumps or alveoli, they expand and contract as you breathe. They're very, that's where you get, and lung surfactant helps with this process.
So you pack a tennis court area into 1 cubic meter.
Right, you're exactly the point. You try to pack a tennis court of area in a fractal, in an optimal structure in this, so you get minimal air resistance. The idea is to reduce air resistance, so you don't have to work. So this air pumped is driven, of course, by it takes energy to do it. The diffusion of oxygen in and out is completely passive, and CO2 diffusing out, diffusion of oxygen in and CO2 out is completely passive. There is no.
Michael, will you talk about why there is no Laplace instability, why the smaller alveoli don't empty out in favor of the larger alveoli?
No, I will not talk about that, because those are cells, so they're not really, this is not really a liquid.
No, but there's tension on it, and so you might, if you have two and one of them gets a little smaller and the other one gets a little bigger, the smaller one will.
Right, right. No, I will not talk about that. Sorry.
Is it known? You ask us if everything is known.
I don't know.
But oxygen and CO2 should penetrate also through membrane to reach the blood.
Yeah, they go through membrane, exactly. So there is actual diffusion through the membrane, absolutely. So the idea is the membrane is really very tiny. There are tens of microns. Membrane. So that is the diffusion is through the membrane.
Michael, this MdQ being constant.
Right.
Is not necessarily.
No, it's not. It's not a priori. What you want a priori to do is you want to construct a structure to minimize the net drag. So you sum all the you're doing parallel and sequence resistors. And the law is such that the resistance of a pipe is proportional to the length. There's a diameter of the fourth power and length, reciprocal length of linearly. So the longer the pipe, the higher resistance, the larger is the diameter, the lower resistance to the fourth power. Sorry, the other way around.
Okay, yeah.
And then when you combine those and you want to minimize, you come up with this answer.
But there is another requirement that all of this
constant volume
should fit in.
So you do it under constraint of constant volume. Otherwise, it will not get. Yeah, you're right. You do minimization with a constant volume. It's actually a very good homework problem. Okay, so the function of the lung is the rapid gas exchange. That's the first function, and the second function is to protect body from harmful substances. You want to keep your body clean, otherwise you will not get you'll get diseases from this. And so I will talk mostly about this clearance problem rather than rapid gas exchange problem. This is more like engineering solution. This is a little bit more molecular issue. So we are breathing a huge amount of bacteria per hour, and all of them, if you are healthy, are cleared without infection. And the way it works it uses this material called mucus sputum and macrophages, and I will talk mostly about mucus sputum because macrophages are much more complicated for me, the actual cells. And so the problem is to understand how the clearance works. And so the picture is you zoom in on the surface, there is air above, there are cells below, and there is this interface. And this interface is where all the action is. And so this is the cartoon picture. You have cells, epithelial cells below, you have air above, and there is a layer which is called airway surface layer that consists of two parts. There is mucus on top, and it's about 30-50 microns depending on where you measure it, and there is a very small important layer in between cells and mucus called pericytial layer. It's about 7 microns thick, and that's so the way the clearance works is called mucociliary escalator. Whatever we breathe in and it clears and it somehow penetrates through the upper defenses, it gets adsorbed on the surface, and it's trapped in mucus, and the mucus is pushed by the cilia, a little extension of the cells. They're about 7 microns long, 200 millimeters thick, and each cell has hundreds of them, and those cilia are beating constantly, and they're pushing like this, they're pushing this carpet of mucus out. And so they beat with frequency about 10 hertz, and the velocity of mucus, resulting velocity of mucus is about 60 microns. You basically take amplitude of motion, like 3 or 4 microns, and multiply it by frequency, you're going to get this velocity.
Well, how did you get this frequency?
Huh?
How did you get this frequency?
How do I get it, or how?
How do they get it?
Oh, I'll get to it in just this one slide. So this is the picture of a little pipe that puts fluorescent particles in the trachea of a mouse, and the particles get absorbed, and they flow towards the head of the mouse, which is down there. So you can see that what you see shaking is the heartbeat, and it moves like a carpet. And so the cilia look like this forest, and the frequency of the cells. So they consist of nine doublets of microtubules, and there are two singlets in the middle. And the frequency comes from the working of danions. Danions are little motors that are attached to this microtubules, and they push group of microtubules with respect to each other. And so the frequency comes from collective pushing and pulling of working danions that walk along microtubules. And so they push forward like this, and they come back like that, and sort of it goes like, so the power stroke, they move forward, and then they come back and repeat the stroke. There is they not all work in phase. There is a phase shift of about 20 microns period. So it's like the engine of a car, they work, some of them are pushing, the others are pulling. So so the mucus moves constantly at the same time, otherwise they would be stuck. And this is actually the movie we took on cell cultures, where we bent cell cultures so you can see it sideways. And so this is a slowed down view of beating cilia. And they beat more, it looks like a cornfield after strong wind. So they bend and beat like this. And here mucus was removed, so you can make a movie. If you look from above, without removing mucus, you basically see this. You can see four contours of cells, and then you see something blinking at the knees, which are cilia pushing this.
Why doesn't it just move the mucus back and forth?
Oh, because the way they move forward is the power stroke like that, and they come under and come back. So there's actually a symmetry of motion. And this is the same objects, very similar objects to flagella. Flagella turned like this, and so the structure is very similar. The flagella is slightly longer, and similar diseases that strike us in lung cilia, like they similar occur, for example, for flagellas in a sperm. So those danion motors are more or less very similar. So it's the same mechanisms occur in many different parts of the body. So yeah, there's a symmetry of the motion. They're not, the motion is symmetric, yes.
Well, do they know which direction they need to move
for it? This is a great question. So when they grow, they sense the flow around them and then train. So when we grow them in cell cultures, and if we impose external flow, they would all grow in the same direction. If you have no external flow, there will be spontaneous symmetry break, and I'll show you a movie later where sometimes they all develop common direction and develop what we call a hurricane. Sometimes there are several hurricanes, so they break into subdomains. And so they basically start, the ones that are growing starts beating, and the nearby that sends the direction of them and the direction of beating is determined by the two central, basically the structure of each of them. So in fact what we did is we can cut a piece out of cell culture, turn it around, so they beat in the wrong way, and after a while, the new ones that grow in the right direction. So they sense, when they grow, they sense the direction of the flows. So there's interaction between them. Okay. So the critical function of lung depends in major way in the stability of this layer. So you need this mucus layer and pericele layer. And the question we are asking is, what molecular structure guarantees the stability and function? And so when you get diseases, and there are a lot of lung diseases, very different lung diseases, there is asthma, there is cystic fibrosis, there is COPD, all of them have to do with some kind of failure of this mechanism. They come for different reasons. Some of them are genetic, some of them are not genetics, but they all lead to very similar observable. You basically have trouble clearing. And the question is there a general physical principle why it happens? And so can we come up with the way of resolving it? Also, can we come up with a strategy for drug delivery? For example, if you want to have inhaled drugs, the same mechanisms that prevents viruses to penetrate through this defense would also prevent drugs penetration. So we have to figure out how to design optimal drugs so you can get maximum penetration, otherwise most of your drugs will be cleared. So that's sort of the question we were asking. And So, and in fact, this is much more general question than just lung. Mucus, the same material is important in many places where we have a contact between hostile environment and cells, in stomach, in eyes, reproductive tract, a lot of places. And it's very similar material. So it basically, it's very general. And in airway, its main goals of the mucus is to trap and stick to particles, bacteria that we breathe in and carry it out. So the first question is, why doesn't this mucus stick to this cilia that are pushing it? Or does it, or why doesn't it? Because it seems like it's moving extremely efficiently. The transport is almost perfect, and it's almost like frictionless, but it couldn't be frictionless because it somehow carries this through.
It's moving, but where's the end? Where is it? And then what does the mucus do?
Then we swallow it or spit it out.
Makes new ones,
more? Oh, yeah. Cells produce mucus all the time. Yeah, when we sleep and when we are awake, it's constantly producing mucus.
There's more than there is blood, right?
I am not sure.
You have a mucus expert locally.
Yeah, I know. I know your mucus expert very well. There is a lot of, yeah, in our body overall, yes, there is more mucus than blood. I'm not sure about lungs. So the question is how to design these drugs that would penetrate this defense efficiently. Another question is why doesn't, if you have this picture, which is the classical picture, you have mucus above, you have the cilia and microvilli, and you have this optic layer, why doesn't mucus penetrate between cilia and basically prevent them from beating? That was the first question that I asked when they told me about the story, and nobody could answer. I mean, they tried to answer, but it wasn't a very convincing answer. So I'll talk about that. So what is mucus? Mucus consists of hundreds and hundreds of proteins, but the main ones, the one that give it its physical properties, called mucins, and they are huge molecules. I was told that mucins correspond to largest genes in our body, the longest genes. They are just one macromonomer is 2.5 million. It's a good glycoprotein. It consists of sections that are glycosylated and the sections that are folding. Even if with the sections folded, which is half of the protein is folded, the contour length is half a micron. So this protein backbone of a macromonomer is almost like a micron to begin with, and some of them are longer. I'll show you the ones that are longer later. But then they also, so they have highly charged regions that make it soluble in water, and then they have these globular regions that are folding. There are two at the ends, there are several in the middle. This is MAC5B, there's also MAC5A, I see that they're sort of similar. I'm just showing you a typical one. And so they presumably act as stickers that make it sticky and to everything. So, but this backbone itself, the protein backbone, gets oligosaccharides. It looks like a brush, and the size of the side chains is about 5 nanometers. They're highly, highly charged. So now the whole molecules that are in our mucus are mucins covered on average hundreds of those, tens to hundreds of those macromonomers. So the molecular weight is hundreds of million. Contour length is tens of 20 of microns, but they're not fully stretched, of course. They're coiled, and so the size is on the order of hundreds, 10 times smaller. So it's about hundreds of nanometers. So they're huge macromolecules that form this mucus. And just to give you an idea of concentration, these molecules would overlap, since they're so large, at very small concentration, about 0.1%. But since in saliva, mucus is above that, in our saliva is above that, mucus is significantly above that. So in the mucus, this concentration is at least 10 times higher. So these molecules overlap. Obviously, otherwise it will be a dilute solution. The viscosity would be same, that of water. So they overlap, and so this is what we call semi-dilute solution, in a sense that most of the volume is occupied by water, typically 98%. The only 1 or 2% of material, but most of the properties are controlled by this material that's there.
That looks like a highly entangled solution?
In a second, I'll show you what. So it's not real. Well, it's a good question whether it's entangled or not. So typical numbers, you have in a healthy state, you get about 1% mucins. In a cystic fibrosis case, you have at least four times larger concentration. And so the picture of the semi-dilute solution is you have overlapping chains, and so you can define a length scale. This length scale becomes very important in a second, it controls other properties. It's called correlation length. So if you have a point, a monomer on one mucin, what would be the average distance to the another monomer on the neighboring mucins? So if they have some kind of a CB radius, how far, what the range should be so they can communicate. And the length scales, the higher the concentration, the smaller this length scale, obviously, they're more and more overlapping. So it typically depends in a good solvent. There is some dependence of correlation length and concentration, like 0.7, 0.75, approximately. Our estimate is in a healthy state, this length scale is about 50 nanometers, approximately. And when you get sick with high concentration, it goes down by a factor of 4 or 5. Proposed vector of 3 or 4. The question of entanglement that Kurt asked, if you assume, we don't know, but if you assume that typically the entanglement mesh is about 5 times the correlation length, that in normal state, they're about at overlap, okay, entanglement threshold, approximately. Because the size of the entanglement mesh is about 5 times that, which is comparable to the size of the molecules. But in a, in a stick state, then the tube diameter is smaller than chain size, so they are clearly entangled in this state, and they're not entangled there. But entanglements are not as important, I think. They are important, but maybe not as important as the stickers. So most of the rheology of viscosity, elasticity time, all of its properties, resistance of particles moving through, depends on concentration significantly, but in addition, the concentration depends on these associations. So these globular domains that stick to everything. And how do we know that? First of all, when we do IFM on these mucins, we can see that the places where they stick to each themselves are these globular domains. And then when we look at rheology, so it's viscosity of mucus extracted from cell cultures as a function of shear stress. If you take mucus as extracted, it has very high viscosity. It's about 10,000 times that of water. As you increase stress, it's shear thins, but still it's very high. If you add something that screens these interactions, it could be different chemicals, but as the screen association with globular domains, the viscosity, this is log scale, viscosity drops by a factor of 100 to 1,000, sometimes 10,000, and it becomes very similar, just a few times that of water. So without stickers, the viscosity would be, because solution is not that much higher than the overlap, would be very close to water, maybe 10 times that of water. In an entangled regime because it's proportional concentration, but due to the stickers, it's 10,000 times that of water. So those stickers are very important. So this is sort of the idea, is how to design drugs to help clearance. If you know what's going on, what are the associations, you can think about surfactants and some other things that you can add that may help you if you want the viscosity to be changed. So these associations have two roles. They absorb and trap particles. So when you have some kind of junk coming in, those associations are control how they stick. And so if you want drugs to be penetrate mucus, they have to be non-sticky. And so you have to understand what non-sticky means for those globular domains. And then they also make a tight mesh because they have additional crosslinks. So they act as crosslinks. And so we have to figure out what is the mesh size, and then we can have to design something that penetrates through. But length scales are comparable to those of viruses. For example, typical viruses about twice the mesh size of correlation length. So this system was somehow optimized to prevent things to flow in.
So what is the lifetime of these stickers? But it's not a covalent bond. So
no, not covalent bonds. Excellent question. we think it's on the order of seconds. So on the frequency of beating cilia, it's a network, and so it goes on the plug flow. But on time scales of flying between pipes, it's a liquid, so it can actually, when you have two pipes connecting, if it was just rubber, it would not flow. So it's just fine-tuned to be solid-like for pushing, but liquid light for following the contour of this fractal structure of light.
So 3-4 hydrogen bonds or something like this.
Depending how strong bonds you're thinking about, but whatever they are, they could be charge groups, hydrogen bonds. There are many different. In addition, there are other things in mucus besides mucins, and so there is a high suspicion that those smaller molecules act as glue between them, possibly. And because our indication is that most of those hundreds of proteins are actually sitting adsorbed on those globular domains. We have some data for that showing that they're strongly associated together. So we don't know whether it's the globules themselves or some other proteins in there that are important for that. And so what we are doing experiments, we're removing mucus, we're putting real polymers and seeing how system different. If you put like a dextran instead of mucus, how different would the system work? And it works somewhat similar, somewhat differently. For example, you can still propel agarose. Puts agarose on cylinder, because it propels it. But if you put it on some inclined plane at 40 degrees, it doesn't flow up. Mucus does. So there are differences. Okay. So the system is basically a race for survival. You have particles that are trying to diffuse through mucus, and this is sort of relevant to what I was talking about yesterday of particle diffusion through polymer melts and solutions. This is actually what is happening there, except the system is a reversible gel, not just simple melt. But we are doing experiments and some modeling of how particles diffuse through a reversible gel. And at the same time, this gel is cilia is trying to push it out of our lungs, so those particles don't get into our cells. And it's a race between whichever one wins. If you increase concentration, you slow down both processes. And if it becomes too dense, then this process loses and the particles penetrate. If you don't have it concentration high enough, then this process will be fast as well, because clearance would not be able to move things out. So there's an optimal race. And so particles diffuse very slowly through high concentration of mucus, but then it doesn't clear. So we want to understand how to optimize the system and make it clear again when it fails. So any questions so far?
This diffusion, is it isotropic? The same diffusion inside the membrane versus diffusion to stay on the...
Well, there is actually, inside the mucus layers, there are basically two layers here. Mucus layer itself is very heterogeneous, because it comes from, the molecules are made inside the cells, they're densely packed in granules. When you need these molecules, the granules open up and there is like an expulsion, because they're packed using divalent calcium ions. And so once they get into water, calcium exchanges for sodium and they basically explode. But initially, they still form like a microgel, because those globular domains are still sticky inside those particles. And so then it takes a while for those open microgels of single molecules to remix and reconnect with the rest of the mucin. So basically, we're studying this maturation process in some cases is slowed down, and there are some diseases connected with that. But in general, once the thing is completely mixed, then it is inside the mucus, it would be overall isotropic. It's highly heterogeneous. The system is completely heterogeneous. Inside the bottom layer, of course, it's not isotropic, because you have cilia that are sticking like this. So diffusion in that layer would not be isotropic. But in the top layer, it's presumably isotropic, though it's very hard to measure diffusion in this direction, in live layer. We put probe particles, but since everything is moving and there is a flow, it's very hard to quantitatively answer your question. So theoretically, it's isotropic. Experimentally, we don't know.
Michael, is there any effect of our breathing on the diffusion of particles across the layer? I notice you're in the diffusive regime. Mm-hmm. You'd expect there to be none, but somehow it seems to me intuitively there will be an effect of our breathing in and breathing out on the transmission rate of particles across the layer.
There is a strong, there is a dependence of breathing on flow of mucus.
Yeah.
Even though we breathe in and out in the same direction, this is asymmetric, and so there is an additional, so there is a air-induced transport. So in some cases, I mean, when you cough, of course, it's a major one, but even if you don't cough, we have normal tidal breathing, we can show that there is an effect of tidal breathing on transport. The way we do it is we compare the rate on mice before they die and after they die, we can compare the difference. And cilia is still beating the same way for hours after mice die, but they stop breathing. And so we can compare the rate, and
so
we can...
thinking about the increased pressure in your lungs when you are breathing out, that might help, I do not know.
For mixing, you're talking about mixing due to stretching or something like that?
Stretching and contracting.
But it's not on a level of, yeah, this it's possible, we don't know that.
You're assuming that there's no effect on
it. We don't know. Okay. I mean, that's in a cell culture, there is no stretching because there is no breathing. We do airflow above cultures, but in that sense, we have airflow above cell cultures. It's not the same as airflow in our pipes.
Okay. But so, if you take marked particles for a patient, do they get, if the patient holds the breath, or if they're breathing in and out, do they get the same rate of uptake of these particles?
Of course, the breathing, we cannot get particles in without breathing. So there is a control of how particles get in depending on the mode of breathing. In fact, the devices you can design for particles to be absorbed in different generations of your lung depending on the type and the way you're going to have your breathing. Particle size and the speed at which you breathe in would deposit particles of a different generation.
Yes.
So there are some statistical studies of airflow that people do that. Yes.
What triggers reversibility of this gel in the meniscus?
Reversibility meaning, well, because bonds between globular domains have finite time.
So it's a time issue? There's no trigger like calcium release or something?
We don't know. I mean, we don't know. It's possible that there is going to be some chemical contribution to that as well. This is something we don't know for sure at all. This is actually a very good issue. We don't know.
When does it last?
What, mucus?
Before you said that you can treat it as diffusion in reversible.
Right.
How long, what's the lifetime before it starts to collapsing?
It doesn't collapse. No. There are two different things we're talking about. The gel itself, if you prepare the gel and keep it away from bugs, it lives forever.
Okay.
What may be reversible is that the stickers, the solid, it's not a solid. It's solid on short time scales, liquid on long time scales, and the bonds are reversible. So the terminology is it's the reversible bonds, but the gel itself is, but then it isn't reversible in the sense of our life, because we are spitting out mucus and a new one comes in. So that there is reversibility of that sense, but each sample itself, if there is no degradation due to molecules being chopped by whatever proteases or some other stuff you have there, if you keep it clean, it can last for days without changing. If it, so yes.
Where is the lung surfactant?
Well, it's presumably it's on the surface of between air and water, typically where surfactants are. And so, since most of the surface is in alveoli, where most of it is, so it helps alveoli changing volume. Whether lung surfactants here plays a role for this association is something we are trying to investigate. This is excellent question. Is there lung surfactant that still absorbs on those globular domains and modifies it? And it is very possible there is. We don't know for sure. So most of it is used, and in fact there are some treatments for infants putting lung surfactants to help them start breathing, and that's for, so most of the, it's, as far as we understand, most of it is in alveoli or in this air-water surface. There is no air-water interface here, but there are some places where surfactants can stick to. So if there are associations, there would be effect of it. In fact, we are trying to design surfactants that would modify stickiness, analogous to lung surfactants, and put them in drugs. Other questions? Okay, so I'll talk about the mystery of this layer, and so the classical model is that you have this mucus on top, you have the cilia and this dilute liquid layer in between that's acting as lubrication for this mucus motion, and I call this the magic carpet model because you have this magic carpet of mucus that's flying or swimming above this pericillial layer like a cornfield, and it catches all the junk that we breathe and it doesn't stick and it flows nicely. But very, very unusual properties. And so the mystery is that if you take this mucus and put it in water, it swells and expands, so it has a positive pressure. It wants to occupy as much volume, most of it wants to occupy as much volume as it can. There are some chunks that are very dense, so they may not swell, but most of it does swell. So it has a positive osmotic pressure. It wants to it wants to suck water in. And so why doesn't it go into these regions where there's water and occupy the space? Because there is no membrane, apparently. We don't know of any possible membranes in the middle of the water that prevents it from coming in. And so the typical answer, so how do we know that it doesn't stop those things? We can put a particle, like a small, so if you have a large particle, like micron-sized particles, it obviously doesn't go between cilia, because cilia space is only a couple hundred nanometers. But if you take a 40 nanometer particle, like polystyrene particle, then we can see that it does, and we label it, and then we label a very small protein, BSA, for example, then we can see that these larger particles, 40 meter particles, still don't get inside the space between cilia. So this yellow here is where the particles are, green is where protein is. This is albumin protein. So this is 7 micron bar, and it shows that you get exclusion of particles that are 5 times smaller than spacing. And the explanation is that there is exotropic motion of beating cilia. And because if cilia is beating, it doesn't let particle in. There is a sort of mechanical explanation. If you have particles and you have something beating in, particles are not able to diffuse. That's sort of the typical explanation. So what we did was to stop beating by giving some drug to the cells. So now you have immobile cilia and particles still don't get in. So the exclusion zone is still about very close to cilia height. And in fact, if you have disease called PCD, pericillial dyskinesia, where your cilia doesn't beat at all or beats very erratically, this layer is still very, very stable. So it's not a dynamical phenomenon. In fact, those people with this disease have, 50% of them have their organs are symmetrically in reverted, because the same cilia that's beating along is the cilia in the primary cell that determines where you, left from right in the bodies. So the same, it's a genetic disease where you have misfolding of one of the arms of dynein motor. And the dyneins are the ones that are making cilia beat properly. Okay, so if you zoom in microscopically in TEM, in the space between cilia, what you see is there's some kind of a mesh there. You see there is it's not empty. And there are some molecules, and you can sort of almost from high resolution TEM get some kind of a length scale, which you typically shouldn't believe, because TEM is freezing, a lot of things can be happening while you're doing this. But it gives you some idea that the stuff there, and the stuff is there's some kind of a mesh between cilia, and this cannot be removed by washing. Typically, you can remove mucus by washing with DDT, for example, but this mesh is not removable. And so if you have unwashed and washed material, you can still have exclusion. So you cannot really remove this mesh. So somehow there is something in there. And so the question is what this mesh can be made of. And the clue is there is a second class of mucins. I told you about mucins that have these sticky regions, and there are several of those, MAC5B, MAC5AC. There is another class of mucins that are equally large and sometimes even larger. They can have lengths of tens of microns. And they have only highly charged region, section on one side that gets glycosylated. So it have like a highly charged section brush here, and it has transmembrane domain. So that the basic like sections that have a domain that supposedly sticks to the membrane, and the rest of the molecule, huge molecule, doesn't have any stickers on it. So they're highly charged. And there are several of them. There is a MAC1, MAC4, MAC16. So they're known genes. And so the conjecture is that these molecules, since they have transmembrane domain, must be designed to stick to a membrane of cell membrane, which cilia also has cell membrane, so they can stick to cilia, and absorb, and form some kind of a brush. And so the idea here is to replace this magic carpet model. We have mucus above as the defense layer, and have this water region below with what we call a brush model, where you have mucus above, and the cilia has grafted polymers, which are the dense brush of this mucins, MAC16, MAC4, and MAC1. They're different lengths, each of them. This is the shorter one, this is the longer ones, and so they have very different density of grafting, but they all secrete a second protective layer. And this is, and the claim is that that's what we see in TEM, and that's what prevents mucus from penetrating, and that's what makes all the properties of this layer so unique. So the rest of the talk, I'll tell you how we study the properties of this layer, how we can prove this. So first, we can do using antibodies for each of those mucins, we can see that they actually are highly represented on the cilia. So you can see the MAC16 near the top, MAC4 throughout, and MAC1 mostly below, but everywhere throughout this region.
So your cilia can look like bottle brush polymer, essentially, stiff bottle brush polymer.
This is a bottle brush polymer, and these are also bottle brushes. So the bottle brush and the bottle brushes.
But what consequence does this have for the beating? Because it kind of keeps the distance rather stable.
Right. And actually, this is what we believe leads to mechanical coupling for the beating of cilia. So this is indeed, you can calculate the force between neighboring cilia if you know the density of bottle brushes. And so they actually make them beat nicely in phase. Typical explanation, people have been working on these models for decades. When it was just pure water, they were using hydrodynamic coupling model. So you could calculate beating of an object and calculating hydrodynamic coupling between neighboring beating, because the assumption was that it was basically water in between. If it is a brush, instead of viscous coupling, we're talking about elastic coupling, which is much easier to transfer momentum. Right, so it is a direct consequence of that. Yes?
You said that some of them are off-phase, so that the mucus then flows.
Right.
In
right, but that length scale for that is this basic is 200 nanometers. Length scale for phase shift is about two decades, 100 times larger.
But it's, you can't calculate that from the elastic.
I haven't tried doing that.
It would be interesting.
No, I haven't tried doing that. In fact, this is an interesting question. There are some. It's also interesting that this wave is travels at the angle to in this metachronal wave travels not along the direction of propagation, but a special angle to propagation, to the motion propagation. So there are interesting questions that haven't been answered. And this is actually would be excellent calculation to see whether you can derive it from. People attempted and some succeeded deriving this from hydrodynamic coupling, though it seems to be going in the wrong direction. The wave goes in forward versus backward, but they get some angles that they have to make some assumptions about coupling and shape of the beating. But yeah, this is an interesting calculation, how to get metachronal waves. And whether they have to do this, because it somehow self-synchronizes beating of walking of dynes. So there's a mechanical signal coming from coupling between neighboring cilia that synchronizes walking of dynes on neighboring cilia. So there's basically, that's how they communicate between each other, presumably. Okay, so now coming up, so a little bit on the brush story. So if you take those mucins, if they're attached far apart, it's called mushroom regime. then Mach 1 has size in a random coil of several tens of nanometers. Mach 4 is about 100 nanometers. Mach 16 is much bigger. It's about 300 nanometers as a coil, free coil, approximately. And so as you increase grafting density, they begin to repel each other and stretch. And so you can calculate from brush models how they stretch proportional to like 1/3 power of grafting density. So this is the grafting density. And if you graft them denser, the height of the brush is larger. And this is log scale of height of the brush versus log scale of grafting density. And each of them will become very long. Depending if they're highly densely grafted, it will be huge. If they're not densely grafted, it will be smaller. This is like a log scale. And we don't really know exactly what the grafting density is, so we can only get some guesses. And our estimate for the grafting density is about 10 to the minus 3 nanometer square. So we guess approximately within factor of 2 to 5 that the grafting density is somewhere here for these molecules. But then the spacing between cilia is about 100 nanometers. So this tells us that these brushes, apart from Mach 1 brush, all these brushes actually, if they're grafted that densely, they will have larger size than the spacing. So it means that they're compressed. So these two brushes, even if they're all by factor of 5 or 10, they will still be compressed. So it basically tells us that the opposite brushes from cilia are under compression, which was a big surprise for me first, but I thought you can estimate even the pressure inside this layer, because from the mesh size divided kT over mesh size cube, you're getting a pressure of about kilopascal inside there. It's a significant pressure, and if you multiply that pressure by the area of a cilia, which is about a square micron, we're getting a force between neighboring cilia of hundreds of piconewtons, which are very large forces. They are definitely smaller than the stall force for Dynein motors, but they're significant coupling forces. So there is a strong force. It's just since this is forces from all directions, then basically they balance in each cilia in the middle. But it's a large, strong coupling. And then this fact that they're under compression means that when cilia is beating a little bit out of phase, they open up and keep the space closed. So you can think about if brushes are compressed, and if cilia is beating out of phase, like in the metachronal wave or some other reason, then when the space between cilia is increasing, brushes expand, and there is no opening of space here, so nothing can still penetrate.
Is this assuming that these are regions are effectively flat, or you put in the curvature, or the silica or the particles are so big that compared to the spacing that
everything is the same scale. So this curvature of the cilia, or the size of the cilia, is comparable to distance between them. So curvature is relevant. It's order correction for curvature of order factor of 2. So for the calculation, you can do simple calculation for flat surfaces, but you'll be all by factor of 2 or 4 or 2 in your numbers. So if we want to do it, it's better to do it in real cylindrical geometry. Or since we don't know exactly the grafting density, that we still have off by a little bit. So there is a issue of, yeah, the curvature is relevant, presumably, especially at the top.
Yeah, I expected more than a factor of 2 or 3 in the pressure in the force calculation.
Well, for the force calculation, it doesn't matter as much, because what we show is that the mesh size, if what you're thinking about is if you have a cylindrical brush, then the correlation length is increasing radially. But if you start compressing it, the correlation length on the outer shell becomes the same, and it's at the inner part will be increasing. So this is the point of if you look from above, you have your cilia, and you have your brush in a cylindrical geometry moving gradually, then the correlation length in a free brush grows as square root of distance from the center. So this distance here, which is psi, is proportional to distance from the center, which is r, to the power of 1/2. In cylindrical geometry. It's linearly in spherical geometry, it's 1/2 in cylindrical geometry, and it's 0 in planar. But as you start compressing, the outer shell initially becomes uniform because that's the compressed state, and only the inner shell, when the mesh size is still smaller, is changing. As you keep compressing, all of it becomes the same uniform. So basically, they're compressed to the state where the whole cylindrical symmetry is lost in this dependence. So all of the correlation lengths are the same. That's what we calculate. And that's roughly what we are testing, but again, this is not absolutely sure. So at this level of the compression we are talking about, the fact that this correlation length should be increasing towards the center is raised because of the compression.
This compression, would it not hinder the transport of nanoparticles?
Absolutely.
Inside?
It is. It does. And that's actually part of the design of the system. So in this case, for example, viruses cannot easily penetrate because the barrier is always on. So that's what I want to talk about first. So if you have a very small, so you have this mesh size inside this layer, and there is a mesh size in the mucus, and so if you have a particles that are smaller than the mesh size, they can freely penetrate through, and the polymers that are smaller than the mesh size can freely penetrate through. But if your particle is larger than the mesh size, they would not penetrate. And polymers will not penetrate. You can calculate because there is already this thing is grafted. There is already a dense system inside. So if the particles penetrate, they would force these polymers to stretch more. So there is elastic resistance for this. But if you have a small particle, like a little mouse, it can still go through because there's space for that. So you can calculate for particles what is the free energy cost for squeezing a particle inside this brush. And that's the ratio of the size of the particle to correlation lengths cube. And for polymers, it is squared because the fact of dimensionality is 2. So there is a partition coefficient of exponential of this cost that tells you how few particles would be here compared to there if their size is bigger than the mesh size. You can calculate that, and you can. So what we are doing is actually want to test. So we're designing a system. Experiment to test this. So what we do is we take a polymers, fractionate them to be of a particular size, for example, 20 nanometer polymers, dextran, and put them, remove mucus and put them on top of the cell cultures. And we see that they don't penetrate very well, so they basically sit, we believe, on the top. How do we know that? We use another color polymer with a very small size, 10 times smaller. We mix them together in very dilute solutions. And so small polymers penetrate all the way to almost all the way to the surface. Large ones don't. Now we mix them together. And so when we see yellow, it's the region where both green and red polymers are. And then the red zone is the exclusion zone for green polymers. So we can now change the size of these polymers, stay still in dilute solutions. And so if these polymers are 2.5 times larger, this green exclusion zone is not that much bigger. It's only 6.8 because the cilia height is 7 microns. But as you make those polymers smaller, like twice smaller, the exclusion zone becomes smaller. And if you make it very, very much smaller, we actually get almost all the way to the surface. So what we can plot is, so the picture is the following. You have this mesh of this brush that presumably has different mesh size near the top and near the bottom. It gets denser as you get in. And so what we can now plot is the size of our probe polymers, which are dextran in this case, as a function of distance from the surface. And this is the height of the exclusion zone. So the polymers are very, very large, like 60 or 50 nanometers. The exclusion zone is 5 to 7 microns. As this probe polymers become smaller, they penetrate deeper, and very small polymers get all the way through. So we can get roughly this dependence of penetration or exclusion zone on the size of the particles, and typical number length scale is about 20 nanometers. So typical mesh size inside here is 20 nanometers, and that tells us that particles bigger than that, like most viruses, will not be able to penetrate. And we also use particles. And particles of this size, and they also get excluded about the same way. So this is two particles, 40 and 20 nanometers, and they're slightly higher because, I remind you, the exclusion zone was proportional to the cube of the ratio for particles, because particles have dimensionality of 3, where polymers have dimensionality of 2. So there's a slight shift, but not significant. Any questions on this?
Your cartoon indicates that the mesh size is changing with depth.
Right.
Because presumably the smaller ones have a higher density, or?
Well, the grafting, the idea is the grafting density. Because you have presumably grafting density. We don't know why, but it clearly there is a denser system grafted here than above. That's what we don't have a good explanation, but that's how the system is designed. It is designed to have exclusion that is presumably. I mean, that's the picture that comes from the data. And they presumably get shed up as they, so they produced here, they moved up and they get shed, those brushes.
Well, it's consistent with your picture, the shorter ones are more at the
bottom. Right, right.
Which means presumably a higher
graphic density
and smaller.
Right. That's the current picture. And in fact, there's also Machiavelli here, but they didn't show in this picture where they can be graphed as well.
What role does time play?
Hmm?
What role does time play in this context?
Role time?
Yeah.
Which time?
Of course, this is a kind of, this is a static picture. Mm-hmm. If you would wait for a long time, a few of the particles would progress.
Right. So this is basically
a characteristic time on which the whole stuff has to be exchanged or so.
Well, but what you're saying is that this is what you're showing is the thermodynamics of the system. Of course, there is a probability of these particles to be here as well, with polymer, which is exponentially slow. But if you wait long enough, then you're going to be infected. So there is a potential barrier of penetration, but with enough of attempts, you can beat it. And the closer you are to the surface, the more likely you're to beat it. Yeah. So there is a time effect, of course.
There's nothing known about the characteristic time scales here.
Times, you know, we have the time scale for dynamics. We cannot see tiny events because if it occurs once in an hour, there's not enough signal to see those events. But in a simulation, if you have all trajectories, we can calculate the particle distribution. And my feeling is the time average and ensemble average will be similar because we are sort of almost in equilibrium in the system. So you can, from ensemble average, you can calculate the probability of being there. And if you know a temp frequency, you can calculate the time you need to wait for it to happen. So if you have lots of millions of viruses trying to attack you, then you're going to get infected much more likely. And that's actually what happens when you get first infection, then the rest of them confers are the ones that get out and reinfect again further away. And actually, they take our cell surface with these molecules, with them, to use it as the stealth protection. So that's what viruses do. That's the hypothesis we have, is that they actually use these mucins and to protect them from sticking to the mucus. Because these are non-sticky surfaces. Okay, so the second part that comes out from it is that there is osmotic pressure in the system. And so you have these molecules far apart. Osmotic pressure is just ideal gas law, Van Hoff law. So it's a KT per molecule. So it's a KT divided by distance between particles, between polymers or particles. But if you go to semi-dilute solution, this is the entropic part, this is now interaction part, so these polymers repel each other, and the positive osmotic pressure is due to the repulsion, and it's and this mesh size in normal mucus is, as I tell you, about 50 or 30 nanometers, so they're smaller than this polymer size, and so you can calculate the contribution to osmotic pressure from the mucins. It's KT per this volume. So it's an order of 100 Pascal. So the pressure of mucus is in normal state is on the order of 100 Pascal. This is an important number because what we claim is like measuring your blood pressure and finding out whether you're sick or healthy. We can measure mucus pressure and tell you whether you're going to get a disease or not. And so so when you increase concentration, like if we have dehydration, and dehydration can be due to different phenomena. You can either, because in cystic fibrosis there is a misfolding of ion channel, and these ions get pumped out, sodium gets pumped out, chloride doesn't get pumped in, and you get less water when you get higher concentration. In COPD, you have extra mucus production, so either you get more water sucked out, or you get a lot of mucus pumped in. In both cases, concentration increases. This pressure increases, and that causes the disease. So if you plot pressure versus concentration, in a dilute regime it's linear, semi-dilute regime it's proportional to 2 point something power, and it can very quickly become very high. And so what we want to do is to measure the pressure of mucus separately and the slayer separately. So how do you measure the pressure of mucus? It's very easy, you just put it in a thermometer. Actually, we designed a thermometer on a cell, so you're measuring a thermometer, osmotic pressure of mucus on top of cell culture. We're putting a tiny thermometer on it. And we can measure this osmotic pressure, and we do see that it's on the order of 100 pascals for normal cases, and it becomes on the order of kilopascals for 6 to 8. And it does follow this law. Now, it's a little tricky to define osmotic pressure of this brush. But since you have this, because brush is attached to the surface, it has some intrinsic osmotic pressure, it has this mesh size. And so the point we are making is if the pressure of mucus is less than the pressure of the brush, it cannot compress it. If the pressure of the mucus, so for mucus to be healthy and move, it has to be hydrated and it has to have a low pressure lower than the pressure of the slayer. If the pressure of mucus becomes too high, the disease starts. And so as long as the pressure of the slayer is higher than mucus, everything is okay. So what we are doing is we are measuring the two pressures and comparing it as a function of concentration of the state. So the way we measure pressure is very similar principle to which we measure the mesh size, but a little bit different. So here we still use the small dextran as a background. Now we take very, very large dextran that doesn't penetrate even from the dilute solution. And this large dextran, instead of changing the size of dextran, before we were doing dilute solutions and we are changing the size to see how it penetrates in dilute solution, now we keep the large size and we change its concentration, so it puts different pressure. So when we have very low concentration, like 0.1%, the pressure is tiny, it's like 12 pascals, and it doesn't penetrate at all. This is what we had before. Now if you increase concentration 10 times, pressure increases by slightly more than linearly because we are going to in a semi-dilute regime, and it still doesn't penetrate. Now you increase concentration by another factor of 5. The pressure jumps a lot because now you're in this 2.3 power regime, and it now compresses or penetrates the layer. So what we are measuring now is the height of this exclusion zone, but not as a function of size of the polymer, but as a function of pressure imposed by the polymer. So we have here the height of exclusion zone as a fraction of osmotic pressure on top layer, and we did it both with dextran and with mucus. And so you see as the pressure stays 100 pascal, everything is fine. This is actually the modulus of pressure. It's a logarithmic derivative of pressure with respect to concentration on a log scale. So when you have pressure of 100, 200 pascals, it's fine. Above 300, it begins to compress, and it compresses exponentially fast, logarithmically, depending which way you look. This is log scale, this is linear scale. So when you get to kilopascal, you begin significantly compressing. If you get to 10 kilopascals, you basically squash the whole thing down. So the picture is, you have this mechanical picture. So we're talking about modulus, which is derivative of pressure with respect to low concentration. If the modulus of top spring is low, and the modulus of high, bottom spring is high, as you add water, you swell the top layer because the softer spring expands more. If you remove water, you remove it first from soft layer until the moduli become equal, and then you compress both of them. So that's what happens in the system. It's basically balancing these conditions. So this is sort of the summary of what we believe happens for the case of mucus. You have the height of this layer, and this is percent of material in the mucus. In a healthy state, at about 1 and 2%, the pressure is, the modulus is about 200 pascal, pressure is about 100 pascal, and the layer is very high. It's healthy, this is the normal state without the disease. As you begin to dehydrate at around 300 pascal, you begin to compress, and this is sort of the marginal case. And when you're just about to get sick, If the pressure becomes as high as kilopascal, and this is way beyond COPD regime, so COPD regime is between 3 and 6 percent solid experimentally, you get really significant squeezing of this layer, and then when you get in CF regime, this which is above 8%, the pressure is in 4,000 Pascal, the whole thing gets squashed. So this is the story of this layer, and then the question is what happens with cilia. So if cilia is very stiff, you can compress the brush without affecting cilia. But if cilia is is softer than the brush, then you can gonna bend the cilia. So what we did is in bright microscopy, we can actually measure the height of the cilia. And so this is the plot of cilia height as a function of pressure. And we used different objects. We used mucus, agarose, or dextran. And actually, dashed line here is exclusion zone that we did before by this fluorescent method. And this points here is the cilia height. So there is actually a regime, this is log scale, between 200, 300, and 800, which is a factor of 2 in pressure, where the layer begins to penetrate, but cilia still high, stands fine. But then above 800, cilia begins to bend and it crashes down, and then it's basically compressed and it's beating below, but it's not able to propel. And so, so at high compressions, cilia is compressed and not able to move this, not able to propel mucus. To check this osmotic pressure, what we did is we used the same dextran chemistry, but instead of using very large molecules, we use tiny molecules with the same pressure. But if molecules are smaller than the mesh size of your brush, they would penetrate through and not compress it. So we used small molecules of 2 nanometers. And you can see that you can go to pressure way, way high above anything, and the cilia will still be standing. Cells begin to be unhappy because you now compress the cells, but the cilia is still standing and beating normally. So this actually depends on what is compressing. Tiny molecules like drugs can penetrate through the mesh at high concentration and not affect the cilia. But if the molecules are bigger than the mesh size here, they squash the cilia. Okay, I think I should probably stop, so I'll skip the rest thing. This is the announced advertising that we have positions in the lab. So what I didn't talk about is how mucus, basically what Kurt asked is how does, as you increase concentration, what is the interpenetration zone between mucus and PCL? And as you increase concentration, at some point, you can plot that the penetration depths of mucus into PCL increases, brush height decreases, and at some point, PCL and mucus gets to the cell and sticks to the cell. And so we study adhesion and of mucus to the cells, and we design a device where we pull like a pill test. So the problem here is the following. Really, when we get sick, what happens is mucus doesn't flow because it sticks. And the reason it sticks is because as you dehydrate, and it penetrates and it sticks to the layer, if you go above some concentration, even if you go below this concentration, you can rehydrate, there's no problem. If you go above this concentration and stay there for a while, even if you rehydrate, the thing doesn't move. So there's some kind of adsorption process. And so we design a device where we measure adsorption. I'm going to skip this time, but we're measuring fracture toughness of this layer and see that it's what value it has in normal cells and in CF cells, and see how rehydration affects and reduces this adhesion. I'll skip that. There is also, for the particle penetration, there is a barrier that we talked about. So you can calculate the penetration zone up this barrier. That's, I think, what Kurt was asking. And how it depends on concentration, and how likely you are to get to the surface. And this barrier actually is, the penetration depth gets smaller as you concentrate. So different particle size, you can calculate how far they're going to penetrate. But the surface, the thickness of the brush becomes smaller, faster, and so at some concentration, even largest particle can get in. So this is again for calculation of that. And the last issue is how do you get, how the cilia be at all if you have this brush or gel in between. What is the friction between them? And so we talk about polyacrylate brush friction between, and there is actually a high slippery, they're very slippery. So polyacrylate brushes, and this is something we're doing extensive simulation now of nonlinear friction of polyacrylate brushes against each other. I think Gary has done some I think polyacrylate.
Not charged.
Okay. So it turns out that experimentally, at least according to Jacob Klein, if you look, friction between neutral brushes is relatively high. If you look at friction of charged brushes, it's extremely low. And the explanation is that you have osmotic pressure is due to counterions, and the friction is, you can calculate friction. So the point is the friction coefficient, according to the scaling theory, does depend on compression. And so as you compress more and more, friction coefficient doesn't change because they both pressure and friction have the same dependence on compression. So we're doing, so we have some preliminary data to test that in linear regime it seems to work, but we're not sure the brushes are in a complete linear regime, so we're now trying to understand nonlinear friction. So to finish, the main point is that you have this first layer, which is mucus, which is classical defense layer, but in addition to it, you have the second layer, which is this PCL brush, that creates a barrier against particle penetration and against mucus penetration. And the mesh size here is about 20 nanometers, and if you divide Kt over this number cube, you're getting this magic number of a kilopascal, which is the pressure inside this brush. If your mucus modulus is below that, you're healthy. If your mucus modulus approaches this or above that, that you collapse and cilia cannot beat, and you cannot clear mucus, and that's when bacteria colonies grow. And this is actually a unified description for both pathogens, for both diseases like COPD, CF, and asthma. They come from different reasons, but they all lead to the same effect. And so the mucus concentration is increasing by either by dehydration in CF or by mucus overproduction. In both cases, you lead to this compression of PCL, and cilia has problem beating and mucus doesn't flow. So how to prevent this? And this is what we are working on now. You can use rehydration, for example, using saline vapor, it really helps. So this is one of the easy ways of doing it. You increase osmotic pressure of ions, water comes in. And we are now trying to figure out what controls this mucus adhesion, the PCL, and trying to find out drugs that stop that. Okay, I'll skip the story with the from the blind man, but this is actually how we started working on this project. We have a group of people from math department, physics, chemistry, medical school, all working together and trying to figure out what this is about. So this is acknowledgement to the medical doctors, they're biophysicists, they're biochemists, and they all come from different backgrounds, and biologists. We have now mice knockouts with MAC4, MAC16, MAC1. And my student just defended his PhD earlier this month. And I would like to acknowledge support from NIH, NSF, and CF Foundation. And this is the promised hurricane. Thank you.
What prospective postdocs are going to see? That's what prospective postdocs are going to experience.
Yes, exactly.
No, this is the group of existing postdocs photographed. You can see all the
So Michael, so you know, small molecule drugs will diffuse through that whole system, but they're trying to deliver the drugs, they're contained in something else. Is that an issue that people...
Well, if you make the drug smaller than the mesh size, and if you make them non-sticky, they will easily penetrate. So the length scale you're talking about here are 10 to 20 nanometers. Those length scales, and we actually have a technique now for making particles of that size using perfluorinated polymers as the mesh. And we are now also playing with shape of the particles to see whether you can make them longer and thinner, they can still move through. The issue is how to make them not sticky. What is the surface properties that would prevent them to be attached to those globular domains in mucus? Once they get through mucus, the PCL doesn't have those sticky zones, but mucus does. And so we are playing with pegulation or some other techniques to densely graft the surface of those particles with like tiny brushes that would repel. Because the global domains have positive regions, negative regions, hydrophobic regions, so whatever you present, they're going to stick. So you have to try to find something that would be non-sticky for all of them.
if I'm thinking about getting rid of the junk, is it only flow of mucus out or some microphages?
Yeah,
where would they reside?
Huh?
They reside in the mucus.
In the mucus itself.
When the stuff comes, they come from the cells and then they do it in the mucus. And that everything moves out.
My second question, do you have any hypothesis? What's the role of the... You're talking about bubble brushes. What's the role of the bubble?
Oh, that's the charges. I mean, that's how you get highly charged regions. The idea is the local ionic atmosphere inside there is significantly higher than anything outside. And so that's how they become insensitive to a lot of things. And there are a lot of condensed contrion live in this first few nanometers around this charge layer. And in fact, it's very, very similar structure in aggrecanes that are in our joints that act as lubricants there.
So
they're longer, they're like 20 to 20 millimeters or 25 millimeters.
So you think that this either is homogeneous along your chain?
That's a great question, we don't know. I mean, from the point of view of the genome of proteins, they're homogeneous. Well, how they are oligosaccharated, that's beyond my knowledge of biochemistry. And we are trying to determine this. We are trying to do some scattering of those molecules to learn something about that. Like neutrons is a good way of looking. But so this is, or what is the persistence length? This is a big mystery. Depending on who you ask, it could be anywhere from 20 nanometers to 5 nanometers or 10 nanometers or whatever. We don't know. And that will change all the numbers, of course, because if you have different stiffness of those molecules, what are brushes? They will get very different scaling predictions or different models, and we need to measure that, and it's not easy because it's bottle brush. But eventually somebody will succeed. I'm not a good scatterer.
Do you extract? You're talking over lunch about how much you have.
I don't want to talk over lunch about extracting mucus.
That's for me to choke on my lunch, but. I mean, how much you really extract?
When my student was working on this, we had a mucus farm. We had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of cells, cultures, producing them. And then you collect them, and eventually you get enough to do even rheology, put in the rheometer. The problem right now that I'm now very concerned about is how the way you're extracting it, you change it. And so what we found, it was a big surprise to me, is when you measure osmotic pressure of the extracted mucus, and compared to the osmotic pressure of mucus on a cell, they are all by several orders of magnitude. And the extracted mucus can have any osmotic pressure you like depending on the day of the phase of the moon. Because when you do extraction, they add something to it, and that affects the association domains. And so it's really how to take it away without changing it is something we haven't figured out. So I don't want to do scattering on a cell yet. Neutron scattering on a cell would not be very easy.
Michael, I have a question about your introduction, the very introduction part.
Okay.
Concerned about continuity. If you start from the very low portion of proteins and you move your mucus with the speed of micron per second, or whatever it is, and then it comes to coarser parts, the amount of surface gets smaller, and therefore either it should move faster or it should pile up.
Yes.
And I did the calculation, and
the
thickness became 1,000 times bigger.
Okay, so this is the remaining mystery that it wasn't planted, but yeah, this is the structure. So you're asking about this huge divergence of area. So if it's moving from here, it all collects there.
I actually traveled other way around.
But mucus travels this way.
Yes.
So there is issues how does the mucus thickness is controlled and flux balance between different generations. So there are different ways it can. So let me skip this. And so it actually, if you do the experimental studies, the flux is the product of cross-sectional area and velocity.
Or even if you don't do it.
But, okay, the story is, okay, so let me tell you the story is, if you, the actual height of cilia is changing with generation, and the velocity of propulsion is changing with generation. The thickness of mucus layer is also changing with generation. And if you actually look at existing data, flux somehow magically almost cancels. So it's almost constant.
It's constant.
It's almost constant, which is not quite satisfactory because there's still mucus production throughout the whole system. So assuming there's no production, you put everything at the last generation, with existing data on velocities and thicknesses, which is very hard to obtain. If you're doing a simple calculation, thickness times velocity gives you flux, it's almost constant throughout the whole range. So this is what I'm saying.
I see. Okay.
It's a mystery, so let's see, this is the plot of when you multiply everything, it comes out to be the dependence of generation is e to the minus 1, 12 plus minus 0, 4. So it's almost constant. It could be from this to this. We don't even know. This is the answer. So how to explain, is there a regulation, or is it just that? We don't know. So there are some models. For example, if the thickness becomes higher, is there less produced?
For instance, it might be related to the experiment that you described when you teach your cilia to beat in some direction. Maybe you can also teach to beat them in a certain frequency.
Right. No, I think that frequency is pretty fixed. I mean, it's very hard to change. It's from the same. So the problem is, there is a deep equation. How does cilia know about the height of the slack? Okay. It doesn't have a sonar to send it and to find out where the surface. So, and if it moves as a plug flow, how would you send, if you're sitting at the bottom with some bead, how would you sense how thick the layer is above you, if you want to regulate?
Yeah.
You can think about...
I should couple into the mucus layer.
But it couples only to 7 microns, mucus layer is like 50 yes. microns, so how do you know, is it 50 or 70? If you're beating here, and if you have a force, you do have force transducer, say this, see that it has diamonds, how does it know whether the gel it's moving is twice the height or not?
So the question is, on that characteristic time scale, does this mucus layer look like a
gel.
Solid or a gel or like a liquid? And if it looks like a gel,
yeah, it does.
Then it feels how thick it is.
No, it feels how it feels its modulus, but yeah. How does it know its height? Because what Shura was asking about is the balance of, is basically balance of flow, at the volume.
Yes, the question was clear.
So we have several conjectures. It can be looking at the gradient of oxygen, or it may be sending some molecules. I couldn't figure out exactly. I mean, there is no clean solution of how to design a system that would sense the height of river above the ground. And so it's not known. Yes.
Talk a lot about the transmission of pathogens in the last part. How does it ultimately affect the absorption of oxygen and people's breathing?
Right. I think that by the time you get to the place where you breathe, which is in alveoli, there is almost no mucus there. Mucus is produced by ciliated cells, mostly in generations of the pipes. So the alveoli are mostly in the respiratory part, and that part has almost very little mucus. It's mostly water and surfactant there. Otherwise, it will be very hard for those alveoli to expand and contract. And surfactant is used to reduce surface tension, so it's easy for it to expand and contract and pump stuff out. So there, in the breathing part, mucus almost plays no role. In fact, we don't want mucus there.
So the pathogens affect the elasticity of the alveoli.
If the pathogens get into alveoli, macrophages will help you, but this is really bad. Okay. I mean, most of the stuff gets stuck in trachea in the first few generations. That's where diseases initially start. Then they somehow manage to propagate down using some other ways. And that's where you have to use some other biology, like macrophages or something else. The mucus flow there would not...
It's not relevant.
Well, I mean, the thickness of layer there, as Shura was suggesting, is much thinner. And so they're much more vulnerable down there. And that's why a lot of bad diseases start at those high generations. And they're much harder to keep.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.